Celebrity pics are stolen. What does this mean for cloud services or security generally? ACLU v. Clapper. Arguments before the Second Circuit. Cleveland rocks this week with content marketing. And the state of public trust in others, their institutions, and among our youth. That's not all, but it's a start. Welcome back to 40ANM N5, the weekly download of 40ANM LLC. It's Monday, September 8th, and I'm Chris Bohm. First up, without a doubt, the biggest tech-related story of the past week has to be the hacked access to celebrity photos, at least some of which had resided in the iCloud accounts of the celebrities. First reported on Tuesday, about 20 personalities, including U.S. actress Jennifer Lawrence among them, had images of themselves leaked over the internet. The images were initially leaked to the image posting website 4chan, although copies of the images spread to other services including Reddit and Twitter, from which they were subsequently deleted by administrators. Celebrity blogger and website host Perez Hilton, who initially had posted copies of the photos as well, took them down and then issued an apology after heavy criticism from readers and others typically approving of Hilton's reporting. While some of the images were faked, others had confirmed their authenticity, including U.S. actress Mary Elizabeth Winstead, who posted to Twitter that, "Those of you who are looking at photos I took with my husband years ago in the privacy of our home, I hope you feel great about yourselves." And, knowing that these photos were deleted long ago, I can only imagine the creepy effort that went into this. Apple spokeswoman Nat Kuros was initially quoted by Reuters as saying in an email that Apple was actively investigating the report. But by the close of Tuesday, Apple released a statement saying that none of the cases that they had investigated resulted from any breach in any of Apple's systems, including iCloud or Find My iPhone. Apple added that, after more than 40 hours of investigations, they had discovered that certain celebrity accounts were compromised by a very targeted attack on usernames, passwords, and security questions. Apple urged all users to, at the least, always use a strong password and enable two-factor verification on user accounts. Ars Technica pointed out this past week that the hackers' intent wasn't, it seems, only for voyeurism, as people who said that they could provide the images on 4chan asked for money in exchange, one using a Hotmail address and a PayPal account, and the other seeking contributions to a Bitcoin wallet. Although many cloud providers may encrypt the data communications between a customer device and a cloud account, this does not mean that the image and data is encrypted when the data is at rest, although this is the case with iCloud accounts. Some had speculated that the hackers might have used iBrute, which was once able to repeatedly try different combinations of passwords on Apple's Find My iPhone service until the combination worked. Once into the app, iCloud passwords, data, and images are accessible, but iBrute only worked until recently when Apple limited the number of possible password attempts on Find My iPhone to 5 before locking the account. The hack, though, does raise questions among users who may not be entirely certain when or if material that they delete from a cloud account is truly deleted. Cloud services are composed of remote data centers that store information, and a hosting company such as Apple will have many physical storage centers with multiple servers spanning many locations. These physical storage locations and servers can be the source of breaches or leaks, though rarely, and such does not seem to have been the case here. In some cases, IT systems are subcontracted to other suppliers, which may have encryption that matches the supplier, but not always. A larger business will typically have the option and the clout to seek IT assurances and to map out and manage risks, but for consumers, in addition to choosing a reputable cloud service provider carefully and checking the terms of service, passwords and two-factor authentication are a fundamental first line of defense. Also, the safest route is to disable automatic cloud service backups that could store sensitive images or data for you remotely until you are sure both of the service, its terms, and your ability to control what is yours in the cloud. The American Civil Liberties Union v. Clapper is one of two cases challenging U.S. National Security Agency surveillance practices that are now either in or headed to U.S. appeals courts. The other, Clayman v. Obama, was filed in Washington, D.C. federal courts just one day after the first surveillance revelations became public, and on which U.S. District Court Judge Richard Leon ruled last December. But it's ACLU v. Clapper that captivated legal audiences last week with an hour and 45 minutes of oral argument before the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit. The appellate arguments were unique for several reasons, not the least of which was the length. Judges typically grant each side only 15 minutes for an argument, more time for rebuttal. The case was also broadcast by C-SPAN and is available for replay online, the first Second Circuit argument of which I'm aware to grant that access. If you choose not to watch the arguments yourself, depending upon whose summary you read, you will likely get slightly different takes on which side fared better before the judges, although the issues in the case, regardless of the outcome, seem all but certain to reach the Supreme Court. Of particular concern to the judges during Tuesday's arguments was the breadth of the government's rationale for bulk collection of so-called metadata on phone calls. Judge Gerard Lynch asked, "Isn't it at least relevant to you whether somebody about whom you have a reasonable suspicion to have engaged in terrorist connections has used his credit card to buy a ton of fertilizer, as it is for you to know whether he's called his gym?" The government argued that the same standard for bulk access applies to both types of data, and some bulk collection of financial records is already underway. The Wall Street Journal reported this past January that the CIA is building a database of international money transfers that includes millions of Americans' financial and personal data. The judges also seemed to question the assertions by Assistant Attorney General Stuart Delery that Congress had ratified the bulk collection program by twice renewing the statute used to pursue the surveillance. Judge Robert Sack commented, "I wonder how valid that ratification argument is when you're dealing with what is essentially secret law." Judge Lynch followed up with the notion that, while it may not settle the constitutional issue of whether the surveillance violates the Fourth Amendment, this court could say, "We don't think that this is something authorized by Congress," which would put it to them to actually act on whether they think it is something that should be done. Much of the government's case rested on application of the precedent in the 1979 Smith v. Maryland decision, which permitted pen register metadata to be acquired by law enforcement without a warrant. Judge Lynch suggested that the attorneys put aside the Smith v. Maryland decision for a moment and consider that the strength of the government's case may also be supported by a lack of expectation of privacy in the record. Judge Lynch here was alluding to the third-party doctrine, which suggests that when data is given to a third party, such as a phone company, perhaps all bets are off in a legal sense. ACLU attorney Alex Abdo commented that no one has ever suggested that Verizon's ability to listen to the content of our communications means that we have no expectation of privacy. Congress is poised to rein in the NSA program, perhaps as early as this year, and could potentially resolve some of the issues posed in the legal challenges, but most agree that the case has broader ramifications. Little has been said in Congress on surveillance reform in some time, and the House Intelligence Committee Chairman Mike Rogers, long a defender of the programs, decided in the spring not to seek re-election. When asked about the prospect that the courts should wait on Congress to potentially decide the matter, Attorney Abdo commented that it would be unwise to expect this Congress, or the next, to act, and as the injury is ongoing on a daily basis, even if Congress acts in the next several months, we're entitled to a remedy today. To view the arguments in full, visit www.c-span.org and search Clapper Oral Argument. Telstra, the largest telephone operator in Australia, has this past week issued its first ever transparency report. In it, Telstra revealed that it has responded to nearly 85,000 requests from law enforcement within the past year, including more than 75,000 warrantless requests for customer metadata. The report tracks requests made to Telstra from July 1, 2013 to June 30, 2014, but the figures in it do not include requests from national security agencies. According to CNET's coverage of the reports released this past week, Telstra says that its understanding of the Australian Attorney General's department requirements is that reporting of these figures, in any form, is prohibited by the Telecommunications Interception and Access Act. Of the 84,949 requests that Telstra received from law enforcement during the period, 2,701 requests were accompanied by warrants, and 598 requests were under court order. According to Telstra statements, a warrant is required to access the content of its customer communications, which could mean real-time access to communications as they are carried over the Telstra network, also called lawful intercept, or it could mean that Telstra is compelled to supply the content of communications after it has been delivered. In the report, Telstra also confirmed that discussions with Australian government officials on proposed mandatory data retention reforms remain ongoing. Two companies are in the news this past week for making changes to, or in some cases acknowledging problems with, how they address customer choice through privacy controls. Netflix announced that it would be changing its relationship with Facebook so that user recommendations would no longer be made public. Previously, if a Netflix subscriber had linked his or her account to their Facebook service, Facebook accounts would automatically disclose everything that the person was watching. This was the default setting of the Netflix-Facebook relationship, essentially tantamount to everyone, friends, family, or unknown, having a bird's-eye view on what it is that you take out of the local library. It's hard to imagine why this would have been the default setting, or for that matter, why greater flexibility wasn't built into this relationship and customer tools from the start. But the new controls will mean that Facebook users can tailor their Netflix sharing to an individual-by-individual basis, and the content need never appear globally accessible in news feeds. According to Netflix, the new controls are available immediately to those watching on PCs, Apple's mobile devices, web-connected TVs, and video game consoles, including Xbox and PlayStation. Android-powered devices will be added into the mix within the next few months. Meanwhile, the U.S. Federal Communications Commission's Enforcement Bureau announced this past week that it has reached a $7.4 million settlement with Verizon to resolve an investigation into the company's use for marketing purposes of personal information regulated under the Communications Act. Customer information such as billing and location data, among others, is considered sensitive under the Act, and a phone company is generally prohibited from accessing or using certain personal information except in limited circumstances, like marketing, but that only after getting the customer's approval. This approval is typically obtained through an opt-in or opt-out process, but according to the FCC's release, Verizon failed to notify roughly 2 million customers on their first invoices or in welcome letters of their privacy rights, including how to opt out from having this information used in marketing purposes. According to the FCC's release, the problematic processes in question began in 2006, but were not discovered until September 2012, with the company notifying the FCC of the problem some 126 days later. When the notification, opt-in, or out processes are not working properly, the company is required to report the problem within 5 business days. In addition to the $7.4 million payment, the largest such payment in FCC history related solely to the privacy of telephone customer personal information, Verizon has agreed to notify customers of their opt-out rights on every bill for the next 3 years. For anyone who has ever watched the Drew Carey television show, we know that there are various reasons why, as the show's theme song put it, Cleveland rocks. But apart from Drew Carey, the Cleveland Indians, the Browns, the Cavaliers, and the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, next week, Cleveland will play host to the largest content marketing event in the world. Companies such as Kraft, General Electric, Microsoft, and even Oscar-winning actor Kevin Spacey, lately of House of Cards fame, who is scheduled to give the closing keynote address, will be speaking to businesses from all over the globe. According to the Content Marketing Institute, 9 out of 10 businesses utilize some form of content marketing, whether it's something as simple as an email advice mailer, or as broad and deep as an online media channel with other coordinated content offerings. But most, however, do not have either an effective strategy or long-term campaign mentality to content marketing efforts. While not taking the place of public relations or advertising, those using content marketing effectively see it as an important addition or enhancement to classical marketing strategies. Examples of some of these strategies can be seen in major magazines like Time or Newsweek, in which a story or series of stories on a particular set of topics, say healthcare, will be labeled as a special advertising section, but as a general matter, will provide helpful advice, anecdotes, and useful information, even though they may have been sponsored or developed by a pharmaceutical giant or an association. Sometimes these strategies can be justifiably criticized as blurring the line between news and pure marketing. But consider, for instance, The Furrow, a magazine first published in 1895 by John Deere. Today, it's virtual, offering gardening tips, advice on seasonal crops, and other industry information, with 1.5 million readers targeted to a far broader list of target audiences. Among the industry speakers will also be Julie Fleischer, Director of Data Content and Media for Kraft Foods, who will be talking about Kraft's return on investment from their content strategy around which they've rebuilt their marketing. From Monday the 8th through Thursday the 11th, the conference will host 85 sessions and workshops, as well as 8 marketing tracks. More than 2,500 people from 50 countries and 37 companies among the Fortune 100 have registered to attend, according to the Cleveland Plain Dealer, more than quadrupling the number who attended just 3 years ago. Of course, much of what we have just talked about in our last story relies on public receptivity to messaging, and to a certain extent, reliance by marketers on a public trust that consumers will at least begin uptake of a marketing story or new media with an open mind. Our next story, though, may show that the environment for trust is not what it once was. Psychological Science, a journal of the Association for Psychological Science, has published its analysis of national survey data that reveals a serious decline in Americans' trust of, well, nearly everyone. Jean Twenge of San Diego State University and her colleagues W. Keith Campbell and Nathan Carter, both of the University of Georgia, were interested to understand how cultural change over the last 40 years has affected social capital, the cooperative relationships that are critical for maintaining a democratic society, in which public trust plays an important role. The researchers looked at data from two large nationally representative surveys of people in the U.S., the General Survey of Adults from 1972 to 2012, and the Monitoring the Future Survey of 12th graders from 1976 to 2012 also. Together, the surveys included data from nearly 140,000 participants and included questions designed to not only measure trust in others, but also to gauge confidence in large institutions. The data showed that, for example, while 46% of adult Americans agreed that most people can be trusted in 1972-74, only 33% agreed in 2010-2012. The finding was mirrored in 12th graders, although with a greater degree of decline. While 32% agreed that most people can be trusted in 1976-78, only 18% did so in 2010-2012. Confidence in institutions rose and fell in waves, with responses in both surveys showing high confidence in the late 1980s and early 2000s, and reaching a low point in 2010. The decline in confidence applied across various institutions, including the press, news media, medicine, corporations, universities, and Congress, with a notable exception in the military, where increase in trust occurred in both surveys. Twenge and her colleagues suggest that the trends may reflect a decline in civic engagement and a lack of social capital. Whereas young people today are most optimistic about their own prospects, they are seemingly very distrustful of other people and large institutions, and adults are showing the same trends, suggesting that these attitudes are more likely a product of environment and the times, and not necessarily a permanent generational shift. The survey results and its release can be found at www.psychologicalscienceoneword.org. Well, from stories on lost confidence and trust, let's end the week on a high note, shall we? Unless you've been completely checked out for the past month, or perhaps been somewhere on a deserted island, you followed the Market Basket grocery store chain story in the northeastern U.S. Earlier this summer, the board of Market Basket, a beloved chain of grocery stores in the Northeast, primarily Massachusetts, with about 25,000 employees, ousted longtime CEO Arthur T. Demoulas, member of the chain's founding family. Demoulas was so beloved by employees that for 6 weeks, many thousands of grocery store clerks, cashiers, and other workers protested at stores, on Facebook, on the front pages of newspapers. They made flyers protesting his removal and gave them to customers. Then they reached out to media and politicians to talk about their impossible demand to have him reinstated. Soon, workers walked off the job and refused to restock the shelves. Customers began boycotting the stores in solidarity, and distributors stayed away, putting the economic squeeze on the new management to finally do something. The employees began these efforts at great risk and without union cover, not because they wanted higher wages, but merely because they wanted their leadership reinstated. Now, lest you think that there were clear white hats and black hats in this story, there weren't. The Boston Globe reports that as much as employees and customers vilified the new market Basket Management and Arthur T's rival and cousin, Arthur S. Demoulas, imagine having a replacement CEO only having to change one initial, those bosses did not put the squeeze on workers. Supervisors kept many employees on the payroll through the standoff, it's reported, even when stores were virtually empty and some were protesting. But with Arthur T., the workers had history. The firm had been doing well. He paid them well. New employees by name and showed up at their weddings, their funerals, and acted like he cared about them, their communities. In the end, the employees won. Arthur T. Demoulas was reinstated by the Market Basket Board a little over a week ago, and according to the Globe, the company is forging ahead to open two or three of the five new stores that it had in development by year's end. There'll be quite a mess to clean up, of course, with lost revenue over the many weeks, and as management has said this past week, it's back to business, a 100% focus to get the existing stores restocked with fresh foods, particularly produce and seafood. For workers at a company to stand up and demand a reversal of a key company decision is risky. And even when the rarity does happen, it rarely results in a win. Business management experts and bloggers were in fact scratching their heads this past week to come up with a similar example as to when these efforts like these, by the employees at Market Basket, have come to similarly successful ends. Whether the story has precedent or not, this is likely unimportant to Market Basket employees and their customers. For them and the Market Basket management, congratulations. And that will be all for us again this week. You have been listening to 48MN5. For more information and for our terms of use, visit 408-M.com. All stories for this week's download were reported by at least two online or print news sources or taken directly from relevant releases, with the exception of specific reporting highlighted from CNET, the BBC, Ars Technica, C-SPAN, the Cleveland Plain Dealer, the Washington Post, the Association for Psychological Science, National Public Radio, and the Boston Globe. Thank you for listening. 48MN5 will be back with you again on Monday, September 15th. Until then, of course, make this week and every week one to remember. And bye for now.